Bienvenue à Silent London Podcast. Je m'appelle Pamela Hutchinson. Je suis... probably best not to do that, is it? Welcome to the Silent London Podcast, which this time is coming to you straight from Paris, where I am visiting the Toute la Mémoire du Monde Festival. It's a festival of restored cinema, so it's not just silent, but it's got plenty of silent film, and this podcast is hoping to show you a little bit of what goes on at the festival and take you through my daily viewing. So normally I'd write what I saw at a festival like this and write it down for you with lots of pretty pictures, but a few of you have been asking for more podcasts and know that people enjoy the daily Pordenone blogs, so this is a way to try and combine both of those things. First up, I want to tell you a few things about the festival, because it's quite near to London, but I know that a lot of people haven't been. It's a festival of restored cinema. It's named after the Renoir film, and it takes place in Paris. There's normally a special guest or two, and that's why the dates of the festival often move around. So last year, the guest of honour was Paul Verhoeven, and this year the patron is Joe Dante, and then there's also a guest of honour who's Wes Anderson too. So those two filmmakers are having little retrospectives, plus also they've chosen quite a few films for the programme. This is one of the reasons why I think, you know, when you look at the marketing for Toute la Mémoire du Monde, you don't immediately think, you know, that there's going to be a lot of silent material there. Last year, the posters all featured Arnold Schwarzenegger in Total Recall, and this year, everything is covered in Gremlins, which is absolutely delightful, actually. You should check out the trailer online. Those are just two parts of the festival, and as I'll go on to say, I was going to go to one of the Joe Dante events, and he was going to be there, and I was quite excited, but I gave up my ticket to do something far more silent London-esque. So the first thing to know about Toute la Mémoire du Monde is it takes place in Paris, of course, and it's sort of organised by the Cinémathèque Française, which, I don't know if you've been there, but it's a beautiful building out towards the east of the city in an area called Bercy. But it's not just at the Cinémathèque Française, so you sort of, you have to know your way around Paris, or you have to find your way around Paris. It's perfectly simple to do, but the festival partners with cinemas around the city. So there's the Fondation Jérôme Seydoux Pathé, which is one that anyone listening to this podcast is probably going to be interested in, because they share the silent films. There's a beautiful old cinema building, and it's been restored, and on the top floor has got a little museum of early cinema technology. There are only poster exhibitions everywhere, and then they have a screening room downstairs with a piano. So they show silent films there, and they show things on film as well as DCP, so that's a great place to go. There are also screenings in the Filmotheque, in the Latin Quarter, and in a cinema called Christine 21, in the Georges Méliès cinema, so they're all over town, plus in the three halls at the Cinémathèque. So you need some metro tickets, and you do need to plan your day quite carefully. Like Il Cinema Ritrovato in Bologna, there are different films playing against each other all the time in all the different strands and in all the different cinemas. I would say there isn't quite as much happening, and that is possibly out of respect to the fact that it takes slightly longer to get between venues. If you really want to skip about, you know, you do have to allow some time. I've mostly been going between the Jérôme Seydoux Pathé and the Cinémathèque, and it literally takes 15 minutes. So not all the journeys are that long. One of the other differences I think this festival has to somewhere like Bologna or Pordenone is that it feels a little bit invisible because it's spread out across all the venues. You know, there doesn't seem to be one central hub where people meet. Maybe that's just because I don't know that many people here. But also, when you sign in with your accreditation, you're given a little card that gives you access to the screenings. You have to sort of book tickets with your card. But it's a lanyard-free festival. Yeah, I don't know whether French people are too chic to wear them, or maybe they thought people wouldn't want to be wearing name badges out and about in the tube. And there's no bag either. I mean, I think it's a low-waist thing, but it also means that it's sort of quite invisible. There'll be people walking the streets of Paris who are all part of this festival, and you wouldn't know by looking. There's one more thing about the festival that might be a little bit difficult for some people, in that it's pretty much all in French. Not exclusively. I would say all the material on the website, the catalogue, the schedule, leaflets, all in French, mostly quite easy to read, and they do give the original names of the films too, so you're not just having to guess that. But yeah, French is the language of this festival, so if all the film introductions are in French, if someone speaks a different language, it's only translated into French. All the films will either be in French or translated into French for subtitles. I can just about follow a silent film with French intertitles. It depends how complicated it is and how much specialist terminology there is there. I found the catalogue quite easy to read. There's just short essays on each film. So if you sort of take your time, you should get there. So this year's strands include one strand that's entirely devoted to silent film, which is a strand that's mostly based at the cinema I mentioned before, the Fondation Jérôme Sédoux Pathé, and that is a strand all about the Triangle Film Corporation, which you may know is the film company, film studio, founded by Thomas Ince, Max Sennett and D.W. Griffith. So I've been watching pretty much all of that, and actually that's possibly the best strand, I would say, not just because of my bias towards silent cinema, but because every film seems to be repeated. And so it's quite possible to catch everything, except for, I think, there's a screening of Intolerance, which is a one-off. The second strand that interests me the most would be the restoration strand. So that's a long strand of cinema, which is just full of big restorations, and I've seen some exciting things in there. And I'm planning to see more, and there are lots of silence in there, lots of classic films in there. I've also really had my head turned by the CinemaScope strand, really beautiful. If you love Polyvision, why wouldn't you? And speaking of Polyvision, more anon. There's a strand devoted to British film noir, which looks great, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get to it, just partly because I could probably see those films in Britain. That might be mistaken apprehension. There's a strand about Soviet melodrama. There are the two sets of carte blanche strands devoted to picks by Wes Anderson and Joe Dante, which have really exciting things in. So there's plenty going on. I'm working my way around as much as possible, but I do have a silent bias, obviously. I also have a musicals bias, but you knew that, right? So just as if this was a Pordenone blog, I'm going to take my viewing day by day. I think partly just to show you the kind of variety, or lack of variety in my case, that you can find at the festival, and what it's like to see all these things in sequence. So my first film of the festival, and you know, I was quite wary about choosing this because I was happy to kick off with the Triangle Strand, but this is quite a tricky film. I went to see The Despoiler. The Despoiler was directed by Reginald Barker for Triangle in 1915, and it's set on the Turkish-Armenian border, and it's actually, the events of the film are set within the Armenian genocide, so it's quite heavy weather. It's about terror, and it's about rape, and it's about a German general having to decide whether to let some Kurdish men into an abbey full of women and let them rape the women. I mean, this is basically the crux of it. It's a moral dilemma, and yes, the women are the ones who are bound to suffer. It's a very difficult film. It has some acting that's quite 1915. It has some sexual politics and racial politics that might seem even more dated than that. It's actually very well done. There is a lot of drama. There is a lot of suspense. They do genuinely try to present some kind of moral dilemma. This was one of the films in the Triangle season that is going to be shown with French intertitles rather than original English ones. And that's actually quite important here because what the film that we saw was the later European release of the film rather than the original American release of the film. And between those two releases, America entered the First World War. And so quite a little bit of the narrative was changed to reflect that, and it basically becomes some kind of anti-German propaganda, really. You might find this film quite hard to stomach. It is fascinating to see how people deal with these sort of issues. I mean, you know, we know that people are making films about rape in 1915. There's some very famous examples. This one is possibly not the most sophisticated, but it is a very effective kind of war drama. And yeah, it was a little bit stomach-churning to start my festival this way. So looking for light relief, I have to say, I went to the Cinémascope Française to see the first film in the Cinémascope strand. So the first Cinémascope film I saw was Forbidden Planet. I have to be honest, I'd wanted to see this film for a long time. I'd wanted to see this film for a long time because I'm really interested in Shakespeare on film. It was showing here because it was Cinémascope. The introduction that was all in French, I think, was talking about the fact that the filmmakers weren't used to shooting in CinemaScope and talking about problems of not having the depth of field that they were really used to. I'm not sure that depth of field is the real problem with Forbidden Planet. It's quite bad, isn't it? Yeah, I'm sure it's a very, very well-loved film. Perhaps I shouldn't wait so long before I see something in future because I really thought it was going to be fun, and I found it not fun, not clever, and yeah, people were openly laughing at it in the screening. That didn't help, maybe, but pretty much everything that Anne Francis did or said got a chuckle, and I think that might have been well deserved. Anyway, I sort of did enjoy watching Forbidden Planet because, you know, who doesn't love Leslie Nielsen and science fiction, and it's all meant in fun, but no, not the film for me. It didn't matter though, because the next thing I was going to see was, I knew, going to be something much more spectacular. So I gave up the night invite to the opening party with a screening of Inner Space with Joe Dante there and probably a free drink and a party and who knows what kind of bacchanalian fun to see something called Magirama. And I'm pretty confident that I made the right decision. This was an amazing screening. This really was something special. And I just want to mention something that happened at the beginning of the screening before we talk about the main event, because I think the later section of the screening will overshadow people's memory. The beginning of the screening, we showed something that was not in any way Magirama, that was pretty magic. And these were two films shot by Prince Albert of Monaco. That is, the first Prince Albert of Monaco. They were films shot in 1897 by Prince Albert of Monaco. There was a scene in Morocco, and then there was a scene on the bridge of a ship, the Princess Alice. And they were just fantastic. I mean, it's always wonderful to see this kind of actuality, even this kind of fixed camera actuality on such a big screen, as we saw this in the Salle Georges Franju at the Cinémathèque Française. But the quality of the first film in particular was absolutely mind-blowing. And to think that it was shot so long ago, it really was excellent. And the excitement of being on board the ship in the second clip, really, really interesting stuff. And just one of those things, who knew that Prince Albert of Monaco shot films and that they were any good, or of any interest at all. So that was fantastic, and something I'll always remember. But I will always remember Magirama more. So Magirama is a format, really. So it's almost like we're back to CinemaScope. You're all probably familiar with Jack Hughes, the Abel Gance film about the First World War, in which the dead of the battlefield rise to confront the living with the horrors of war. It's a very powerful film. And he went back to that film and made a sort of sound version in 1937. And then in 1956, with Nellie Kaplan, he made another version. And this is Jack Hughes. It is post-Second World War Jack Hughes. So the plot is sort of, you know, these people died in the First World War, and then the Second World War starts, and one of them, Number, a veteran, is so angry that he calls upon his comrades from Verdun to rise and confront the living with the horrors of war. It is incredibly powerful. It's obviously a sound film, but it's also in polyvision. So polyvision is the technique that Albert Gance uses at the end of Napoleon for the triptych. So you've got, not always, but quite often, three different images, all this sound, voices, explosions. The opening battle scene at the beginning of this film was one of the most intense things I've ever seen. And, you know, then you go into sort of a little bit of a drama about the men in the trenches and their inevitable end, and years pass, and, you know, war is declared again. And, yeah, the scenes, it's very Albert Gance. It feels like, you know, it seems like quite a simple thing to do, but it's done with such passion and such scale that you're incredibly moved by it. When the veteran is calling the dead of the different countries to rise, it's incredibly moving. And, you know, Albert Gance is doing things like, you know, having his face in the centre frame and having, you know, the gravestones either side. There's lots of deep red tinting. He creates these large panoramas just by duplicating images of soldiers marching, or of gravestones, or of the dead rising. The whole thing's magnificent. So it's obviously, there's bits of the silent film in there, and there's bits of the 1937 version in there, and I don't know, there might be some more, I'm pretty certain there's some more material in there as well. And there's sound, really, really loud film. It's obviously not been filmed in polyvision. That is to say, it's not anywhere used that camera where, you know, you had three lenses firing slightly different directions, so that you don't get those kind of smooth panoramas. He's just used the panels. So it's a triptych film, and I've really never seen anything like it. It really was incredibly emotionally intense. As I referred to before, you know, it was in French. The introduction that told me all about the technical details of the film was in French, so I'm a little shaky on those. I'm going to go and find out more about it. I felt that I followed the film because the story is so simple and pure. You know, it's men being sent to war, being sent to their deaths, and then the horror that leaves. Don't think I'll ever forget watching this film. We were lucky enough to have Nellie Kaplan in the audience with us, and she was very chatty and lovely. She was about to start doing a Q&A before the film began, and then she said, "Oh, no, you know, you want to watch the film." It's a pity, actually, that we didn't get a chance to have that Q&A after the screening. We all trooped out, but I think we were all a bit shell-shocked. So, beginning and ending of that day, pretty brutal in their own ways, but I knew that I'd seen a vast swathe of cinema history. I'd seen some really, really unusual things, and quite tired, but ready for my second day. Of Toute la mémoire du monde. Well, I hate to disappoint you, but I was incredibly predictable today. I saw four films, and they were all silent Hollywood films. There was a vast choice, but this is what I decided to do. I'm going to try and see as much of the Triangle films as possible, and obviously a few that I've seen, etc., etc., but I really am trying to sort of get my way through those, and so far that's proven to be a good idea. Plus, there were two big Hollywood restorations at the Cinematheque afterwards, so I went along to see those, even though one of them, I always say I don't like this film, turns out it can be quite enjoyable. So the films I saw were Alain Doyne's The Half-Breed, starring Douglas Fairbanks, then I saw Civilization, directed by Thomas Ince, then I saw Son of the Sheik, directed by George Fitzmaurice, and starring somebody called Rudolph Valentino, and to round it all off, we saw D.W. Griffith's Broken Blossoms, which was a big cine concert held in the large screening hall at the Cinémathèque Française, with a new score conducted by Gabriel Thibaudeau, who, if you've been to Pordenone, you've probably heard him play quite a few times. Fantastic new score performed by an eight-piece ensemble. And so these were four big films. And, they're all good in their own way, and they're all bad in their own way, too. What struck me, I think it's really difficult when we try to map modern values onto older films and older books, because it's difficult because, being progressive, being fair, being without prejudice, these are timeless values, these are timeless virtues, but people's definitions of what were considered, being without prejudice do differ, and there's always language and sort of outdated ideas. So I think, you have to give films credit for what they're trying to do, not where they stumble. That would be my opinion. These four films, all in their own way, were trying to be quite explicitly anti-racism. They're trying to sort of counteract prejudice, and they all fall down in their own particular ways. So it was quite interesting study in that. Sometimes you're sort of cringing, and sometimes you're applauding them. It can be quite, something like The Half-Breed, I think, with the, we know now, Anita Loos wrote, but also Douglas Fairbanks was very sort of sharp. If you read the Tracy Gussell biography of Douglas Fairbanks, you'll know that ideas about race and prejudice were very important to him. She explains this by saying, he had a Jewish father, which he didn't tell anyone, but he seemed to be quite a fair-minded chap, and he would quite often go through Anita Loos's intertitles and take out any of the words she'd used, which he didn't agree with. So you sort of think, well, between the two of them, they've come up with something quite sharp. It's about a young chap who is born, what we would say now, of mixed heritage, in that his mother was a Native American and his father was white. He doesn't know who his father was. He's raised by another man. And the film quite consciously says he's a great chap, and the white men who are prejudiced against him are generally quite awful. There's some very sharp intertitles about the so-called superior white man. Of course, we might wince a little to see them saying, well, no, he's just as good as you. After all, his father was white. As if it's his whiteness that makes him good, rather than just his, the rest of his makeup or his just essential personality. It's funny, though. It's sharp. Douglas Fairbanks is amazing, sort of bouncing in and out of trees and things like that. The female characters are quite well-rounded. This is fun. You should watch this film. The Half-Breed is basically a sort of Western adventure with a bit of romance. Don't lead too much into the romance, or rather don't get your hopes up for that. I definitely highly recommend it. Always love Alain Doyne, always love Anita Loos, and of course we always, always love Douglas Fairbanks. A real shift in tone in the Triangle season was Civilization, which we know is kind of like an intolerance type film. If you haven't seen it, then you know that this was Triangle trying to talk about humanity, perhaps a little pushback to the quite right accusations of racism against the Birth of a Nation. Civilization takes an interesting sort of what if. It's inspired by the bombing of the Lusitania, and what it imagines is if the commander of the submarine who was ordered to down the Lusitania had had a moment, had a vision of how awful that would be, decided not to do it, what would happen next? In this version, what happens next is that he imagines how awful it is, he decides not to do it, he nearly dies, he has a sort of near-death experience, he goes to the afterlife and meets Jesus, and Jesus comes down to Earth in the submarine commander's body to show people the way of peace. It's interesting, particularly considering it was made in 1916, so in the middle of the First World War. The inference is that the submarine commander and his nation is Germany, although it's never said. He's called Count Ferdinand. It's never quite said what country they're from. And what this film does is sort of has its cake and eats it. And it sort of shows you the opposing side deciding to do the right thing and signing this peace pact. But it also shows you the horrors of war and the horrors of the things that they plan to do. It shows you the women and children trying to escape the ocean liner. And it shows you the horrors of the battlefield. In fact, it's a really, really striking film. The vision of Christ, I think, is sort of, as much as these things can be, done quite subtly and with certain intelligence. It isn't quite as good as it needs to be for all this heavy material. The performance of the king, leaves quite a lot to be desired sometimes, but it's really effective. I know a lot of people are big champions of this film. It's always interesting that, you know, we see what else is going on around the big films. Everyone remembers, you know, Intolerance, but a few months before this film came out, and it had very similar sort of ideas and scale. And, you know, so far this festival, I have seen a lot of terrible, terrible scenes of young men being sent off to the First World War and then the horrors of the battlefield. I mean, so far I've seen a lot of that, and this is a pretty gruesome film. Yeah, it's very powerful. The chap two seats away from me who chuckled all the way through, I have no idea why. Yeah, that was quite baffling to me. I wondered whether maybe his wife was tickling him or something. I think you were allowed to laugh though, and I did laugh. Or that people in the audience laughed even more than me. I thought I was cynical at Son of the Sheik. Son of the Sheik is a silly film. That's the state of it. That is all there is to say about that. It is a silly film. And it's also got some intentional comedy, although sometimes you wince a little bit like that because, you know, the characters that they choose to portray as being weak or venal or pathetic in some way are always, they're never the white characters, are they? So Son of the Sheik has got many flaws, but in a beautiful restoration, it had this sort of Cohen film collection restoration there, and Charles Cohen introduced the screening, actually, it looks its absolute best. And, you know, this film is designed to be gazed upon. You know, you're not really meant to take it that seriously, I don't think. I'm sure people have done. I'm sure lots of young ladies have done, and young men, but it is just meant to look beautiful. And I find that, you know, it's just over an hour. I find it feels a little bit longer than that because, you know, I genuinely don't really care what's happening to these characters. But you can't deny the power of Rudolph Valentino smouldering and wearing those sort of crazy trousers with the big cummerbund. It looks great. And there's an awful lot of him just, you know, with his cloaked hood, smoking a cigarette and looking moody, and he's thinking, should be a Garbo or Dietrich. It really is. It's shameless, absolutely shameless. Son of the Sheik, if you don't know by now what that is, I can't even begin to explain to you the nonsense, but it is Hollywood at its best, I suppose. Well, not its best. It's Hollywood being very Hollywood. But on to the main business of the evening, and I think that it's, you know, it's great to go off into the corners of the festival and find all the obscure little things you're interested in, but it is nice every so often to be in the big room. And last night, I'm recording this on Friday morning at the moment, on Thursday night we all went into the Henri Langlois room at the Cinémathèque Française, which is a really, really big hall, and we saw Broken Blossoms. And, you know, full disclosure, I'd only ever seen this film on VHS, so that's quite a long time ago, and it looks amazing. So this is a 2K restoration by the Cohen Film Collection. It is, we were told, sort of a work in progress. They're still building some things, and they have commissioned a new score to go with the film from Carl Davis. So I'm sure that would be marvellous, but what we saw was, in this work in progress copy, was a new score by Gabriel Thibaudeau. And as I say, you might know him from Pordenone or from other screenings in France. And, you know, it was great. It was really, really stunning music. You know, this film, I think, you know, it can leave 2017 audiences behind a few times, but the music was so dramatic and so vivacious and so full of life and so close to the action that I felt like this was a really great screening of a often difficult film. Broken Blossoms, I mean, if you haven't seen it, you've probably seen some clips. You've probably seen Lillian Gish trying to smile, or the terror in the closet scene. Lillian Gish, I'm of the opinion that Lillian Gish is always marvellous, and she's one of the most appealing of actresses working in the silent era. And D.W. Griffiths obviously was a genius. And, you know, for me, it's always a delight to see any film, silent film, I mean, set in London. The more sort of azat, the better, really. There are a lot of problems with Broken Blossoms, partly because it's trying so hard to be a film that shows you that we should all love our fellow man and that racism is bad and that Chinese people are our friends. And if it can't sort of bear to give the Chinese man any of the sort of dignity that you would give any other character, he doesn't have a name, he's played by a white man, Richard Barthelmess, in Yellowface. It's quite interesting, they never call him by his name, and yet he's always standing around his shop, which seems to have a name on it, and you keep thinking, isn't anyone going to call him that name? Is that his name? He's just standing there, and the intertitle calls him by words that we would now, you know, consider to be racial slurs. All the time that they're, you know, trying to point out what a good, honest man. And I do think the sequence when they show his disappointment after moving to London is quite strong, you know, how that hasn't worked out for him. I mean, I think they enjoy the opium den quite a lot. There's a lot of violence in this film, with the whipping and beating of Lillian Gish in particular, and there's a lot of talk about race and religion. What sort of struck me last night was the really, really, really strange attitude to sex in this film. You do wonder that maybe between Gish and Griffith that was always going to be a bit of a tricky area. Donald Crisp, the battling Burroughs, the horrible father, we know he has quite an active sex life. We said, you know, was it one of Battling's girls handed him a bundle of rags and that's his daughter? But the other two are completely sexless. There's actually a little sequence where Lillian Gish's character, Lucy, she goes to visit a friend who's married and has six children, that's trudging away, who says, don't ever get married. And then she goes and sees some prostitutes in the street and they say, oh, you know, this life isn't for you. And it's almost like two people have said, you know, you've got to stay a little girl. And that's what's going to happen. She is going to be a martyr. She's going to die a little girl with a little dolly. But in between, she's going to get sort of adopted by this chap. I'm sorry about the bell. I'm recording this in my Airbnb and there's a school nearby. So there are many, many subtle touches in this film and it's really beautifully done. It's beautifully shot. The scene when Lillian Gish is trapped in a cupboard and her father is trying to get in at her with the axe is just perfect suspense building. I do think that this film is very fine in many ways, but the sexual aspect of it I find really odd. And interesting, actually. I mean, I think these things are interesting. And there's a moment when, in their little chaste relationship, Richard Barthelmess sort of advances on Lillian Gish as if he's going to kiss her. You can tell that he obviously is, well, I mean, the film doesn't want to say it, attracted to her, but he is. He sees her, he thinks she's beautiful, he wants to take care of her. He wants something. He dresses her up, you know, he gives her this little bed in his parlour. And when he moves in, I mean, it's quite hard to analyse Richard Barthelmess's acting in this film because he's got something, all this makeup on, and he's obviously trying to do this pursed-lipped Chinese acting, which is just completely off the mark. But he moves in and it's entirely like Ivan Novello going in for the kiss in The Lodger, in Hitchcock's The Lodger, and also, so similarly, years later, Grace Kelly in Rear Window. And it's a little bit similar to when Battling Burroughs will advance on Lillian Gish, on Lucy later in the film, you know, to threaten her, you know, I'll learn you, all that. So there's something about this man, whether he's a Chinese, whether it matters in this scene whether he's a Chinese man or not, going towards Lillian Gish that is it's a little bit profanation, quite frankly. And it's a very, very strange moment. But of course, then the instrumental says, no, his love remained pure and holy. And you think, oh, yeah. I mean, really, what needed to happen with that character? She could have grown up and got married and lived a happy life with someone. But it's like the film won't allow it, or the story won't allow her to grow up. And so, you know, she stays a weak little child. It's undeniably moving, but it's also very, very strange. And possibly a little Victorian. I don't know. It is a beautiful film. If you do get a chance to see the restoration when it's complete, although it looked very strong, do go. I think, you know, despite the many issues this film has, and it's beautiful and it really shows you the best of what D.W. Griffith and Lillian Gish can do together. Their particular chemistry as actor and director. They might not be moving towards something that we really appreciate these days, but they are completely achieving it. Does that make sense? That doesn't make sense, does it? Yeah, they're getting there. Anyway, so that was my Thursday at the Tutelumai Modern Mond Festival. I think next up are some musicals, so you know I'm going to be happy. I should be happy. Anyway, all right, see you soon.